Are New Yorkers loving the Adirondacks to death? Concerns about overuse in the park have spurred state action. Karen DeWitt will speak to State Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart Cousins, and we'll have analysis of this week's headlines on the Reporters' Roundtable. Casey Seiler of the Times Union will talk to Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio and Michael Gormley of Newsday. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is New York Now.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Welcome to New York Now. I'm Ray Suarez. Law enforcement officials across New York State are calling for a delay of the criminal justice reform set to take effect January 1st. They held press conferences across the state Thursday to decry elimination of cash bail and pretrial detention for most low-level offenses. They say they're concerned that the measures will remove the consequences for unlawful behavior. Meanwhile, advocates of the reform say the previous system unfairly punishes low-income defendants who cannot afford to post bail. We'll have more later in the program. But first, Karen DeWitt recently sat down with State Senate Majority Leader Democrat Andrea Stewart Cousins of Yonkers to talk about the coming session.
Senator Andrea Stewart Cousins, Senate Majority Leader, thanks for joining us again in New York Now.
Oh, it's always good to be with you, Karen. And thank you, and welcome to my district.
We're talking on the off session. Earlier this year, that was pretty busy up in Albany, 2019 session. Really remarkable how many things that were done by the Senate Democrats and the legislature. In fact, I was looking through them, and it's almost too many to name, but a couple of them, the Child Victims Act, codifying the abortion rights in Roe v. Wade into law, early voting, plastic bag ban, property tax cap.
That's
so what we're wondering is, 2020 going to be as energetic, or have you done a lot of the things that you need to do now?
Well, I'll tell you, we were really clearing a backlog. You know, some of these things that you mentioned had been lingering for years, some as many as 10 years. And I could not see any reason to delay anymore. We'd had every discussion we could on reproductive health. We've had every discussion we could on Child Victims Act. In fact, Child Victims Act was extraordinary because when we actually brought it to the floor, not one person voted against it. So we saw this time and time again, early voting, why not? So we will continue to just try and make this the best New York for everyone that it can be.
So one big issue that's on the radar screen is legalizing adult recreational use of marijuana. Yeah. That's been complicated somewhat by the vaping illness that's happening. Are you rethinking? You supported that bill last year, it didn't pass. Are you rethinking how to do legalized marijuana in light of what's going on with the vaping?
Well, you know, first of all, in terms of vaping, I know we're going to be doing a lot of things around that, clearly. The governor had done an executive order. We always believe that codifying
banning flavored e-cigarettes because teenagers are too attracted to them. That's something that you think might become law in 2020.
I do. I think it's extremely important that we do whatever we can, especially now. I mean, the signs are so clear that this is a real problem. It's a health hazard. And like I said, unfortunately, so many of our young people have been targeted and are now hooked. In terms of the marijuana, we did decriminalize because we could not get to that place with, you know, legalization of adult use. We are going to continue to try and figure it out. I mean, one of the big sticking points was, again, what to do with these communities that have been so badly damaged by the unequal, you know, the unequal enforcement
and some of the
these
bills,
laws.
Yeah, want some kind of reparation.
You know, something that you know, rights. So many of the wrongs. So obviously, a lot of people are talking about the money that is involved in this industry, and
tax
how do
revenue.
We make sure that communities, again, Black and Latino communities that have been so, you know, targeted, frankly, will be able to have a role in the economy that's going to grow around this industry. Mm-hmm. And of course, people are concerned about the education. We want to make sure that, you know, we continue to educate everyone about use, abuse, and this kind of thing.
Using
so there's
it
just
safely.
So many, yes.
So what's your prediction? Do you think it's going to pass this year?
I think that there is a path forward, but again, we want to see that the revenue, again, is targeted into some of the communities, again, that have been disproportionately negatively impacted. We want to make sure that
so
there's opportunities.
That has to be included, is what you're saying, in order for
it to pass. It's got to be an entire package.
And speaking of money, the state looks like it may have a budget deficit, the Medicaid budget, a $3 to $4 billion deficit. Cuomo's budget office is talking about delaying a payment for the second year in a row into the next fiscal year and making cuts to providers. Do you think that the budget office should just do that? Do you think the legislature should be involved?
I would love, as I've said over and over again, these are big, big dollars, and it obviously is impacting the healthcare system. I do believe that we should have some involvement in it. It's preferential, clearly, to be able to go over the numbers, the expectations, and obviously when you're talking about cutting, you're talking about cutting into various aspects of our healthcare delivery system. And this is extremely important. And then so much of this is matching. So it's not necessarily just that amount of money, but if it's money that's matched on a federal level, then we are talking about extremely large impacts potentially. And yes, I would want to be involved.
Well, the reason why we kind of have this so-called deficit is the governor has restrained himself to a 2% per year spending cap. You think that's okay to continue with that?
Well, I think that this is an opportunity to take a look in terms of some of these self-imposed caps. And again, I think everybody understands the importance of being prudent with taxpayer dollars. I mean, it's not something that we take lightly.
And finally, everybody's favorite question, or at least my favorite question, the politics of 2020. You have 40 members, right?
Yes.
Very solid majority.
Yes.
Do you expect to pick up seats this year? There's a couple of Republican districts that one of them doesn't have a senator anymore. The other one of them is going to run for Congress.
Yes.
Are those competitive districts, Buffalo, Syracuse, that
yes.
you think you might pick up?
Absolutely. Anybody who's so people laughed at me when I told this was our last election, when I told them I wanted 40 Democrats in the chamber. They laughed, but it turns out that I was right. So now I am predicting 43. And I do believe, again, we have an incredible majority now. I will, keep everybody who's there and add, because I always say 43 is actually the floor. Mm-hmm. It's not the ceiling. Mm-hmm. So I'm open to 50. I'm open to making sure that. And as I've always said to my Republican counterparts, what we're looking for is parity. They had the majority in the Senate for the better part of 100 years. I'm just looking for that.
Yeah, okay. But to that, there's the so-called Long Island Six Democrats who replaced the Long Island Nine Republicans. They're in a more conservative districts. They've already been threatened with primary challenges from some pretty far-left groups saying that they're not, to the left enough. And there's worries that could harm them in the general election and the Republicans could get the seat back. So how do you navigate that in the session, and giving them things that they could come home with it so that they could look good to their voters, but without offending, your New York City and some other members?
Well, again, I think that what we've done and what we will continue to do is really reflective of what New Yorkers want. And I'm a Westchester, senator, and know very, very well suburban areas, and my Long Island Six have been able to do some incredible things with the environment there. Again, the property tax cap was there. We're trying to do as much as we can in terms of education and funding. And I know that we have done a great deal of very important things that are extremely helpful, not only to them, but to the voters that they represent. We will continue to do that. And, you know, I think it's also important to note that there are a lot of progressive groups that have actually come out and supported the Long Island Six as well.
Well, 2020 is going to be very exciting, very interesting year. And we'll be talking to you again about that. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Both New York State officials and environmental groups have long agreed action is needed to address overuse and overcrowding in the Adirondacks, and they're largely united on the state's most recent efforts to tackle the problem. Last week, Governor Andrew Cuomo and Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Basil Cegos created a working group to come up with solutions. The High Peak Strategic Planning Advisory Group will explore ways to maintain the delicate balance between economic activity and resource preservation in the state's largest park. Jessica Blaustein Marshall has more.
This is the balance of the Adirondacks, right? The good news is tourism is up. Economic activity is up. That's the good news. The bad news is the tourism increase is actually creating issues, parking issues, traffic issues, and there's a real question of what's the maximum use of the resources without damaging the resources.
Governor Cuomo spoke to reporters earlier this month before he announced the new working group. He called the threat of overuse in the Adirondacks legitimate.
It's not black and white. We want tourism. We want people to enjoy it. We want the economic development. But we want to make sure we're not spoiling the asset. And that's the balance we have to reach. And there are legitimate concerns.
Concern with overuse in the Adirondacks is not a new issue for advocacy groups. John Sheehan of the Adirondack Council says they've been monitoring it for at least two decades.
Are we loving the Adirondacks to death?
Well, I think we may be. There are an awful lot of people coming to the High Peaks region and an awful lot of damage being done as a result of that. And there are some things that the state can do to deal with those consequences, and I think we have to be prepared to protect the natural resources of the park or people won't keep coming back and enjoying the place.
The Adirondack Park is just over 9,300 square miles of New York's North Country. It's a patchwork of public and private lands. The state has designated 2.6 million acres of it as forever wild. The region is home to about 137,000 people year-round and an additional 200,000 seasonal residents.
Adirondack tourism has skyrocketed in recent years. By 2017, the park had seen 7 to 10 million visitors annually. The governor's office said last year the park saw 12 million. Local officials and environmental advocates are concerned that the uptick in tourism is creating public safety issues and excessive waste, eroding trails, damaging wildlife, and stressing infrastructure.
That's as a result of some pretty steady investments by the state in developing tourism. It's also the effect of having social media repeating the beauty of the park to millions of people who might not have seen it before. And just having that experience brings more and more people to the Adirondacks to see what it's all about.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation has already taken some steps to address the issue of overuse, paying particular attention to the busy Route 73 corridor. Commissioner Basil Cegos says it's a priority going into 2020.
Well, we've been at this for a couple of years now, working collaboratively with sister agencies as well as the local municipalities and many of the stakeholders in the region, getting a handle on parking, actually striping certain areas, putting no parking zones in place, reducing speeds, during peak weekends, doing a partnership with Leave No Trace so that there's better education at the trailhead, and you have people going into the backcountry who are better educated about trash and what to wear.
Sago says the new 11-member High Peak Strategic Planning Advisory Board is made up of representatives from environmental groups, local government, regional tourism organizations, and private businesses.
We needed to create a smaller group that could convene in a small setting and, you know, and pour through alternatives. This is not an exclusive club. This is honestly a team of people that we know can roll up their sleeves and are willing to roll up their sleeves, and that's what I asked of them, is to really lean forward over the next few months and come up with some solutions.
Sago says he wants recommendations from the advisory group by the springtime.
I'm not going to prejudge any of the alternatives that they come up with. I know that there's quite a bit of thinking right now out there about everything from do nothing, is carry on as is, maybe some minor enhancements all the way to a permit system. I mean, I have my thoughts, my personal thoughts about that, and I do not believe a permit system is enforceable within a park like the Adirondacks. But I want the group to research it a bit, and I don't want to tell them in advance to take anything off the table.
Adirondack advocates like Sheehan say they're pleased to see the governor and DEC take action through the working group.
We're very hopeful that this is going to be the beginning of the solution that we're after. What we've recommended so far is that the state take a look at making a new investment, that they do some additional maintenance, and appoint people that are qualified to help them guide the process from here on in. And we're starting to see that happen.
When lawmakers return to Albany in January, they'll also be considering a number of issues that affect the Adirondacks. That includes a bill to curb road salt contamination and vetting the governor's nominees to fill vacancies on the Adirondack Park Agency Board.
All right, and now for some analysis of the week's news. We're at the Reporters Roundtable, where it's great to be joined by Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio. Karen, great interview. And Mike Gormley of Newsday. Karen, just finishing up on the interview with Andrea Stewart Cousins, there was some news that was left on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, she had so much to say that not all of it could even make air this week. But she did make a little bit of news on the Public Campaign Finance Commission that has its report out the day before Thanksgiving. She talked about fusion voting. And if you want to see it, you can go to the web and look at it.
All right.
NewYorkNow.org.
Mike, we want to devote significant time to talking about a really blockbuster project that Newsday unveiled this week, Divided Long Island, that looked at the problem of housing discrimination out on the island, specifically the issue of real estate agents steering clients of different races to housing options that tended to stratify racial differences, ethnic enclaves, as it were.
Which has been illegal under federal law since LBJ signed it in the 60s. What Newsday did was the major undertaking. It shows how important local journalism can be. We sent out two people, always with two pairs of testers, one white, one was African American, another time it would be a Latino, another time it would be an Asian. Mm-hmm. And they were given the same exact financial profile to use, many of these were actors, and asked to see the same property. And they, 40% of the time, they were steered to, the minorities were steered to minority communities, whites were steered to white communities, not even told about the other options. And what's insidious about this, and you can see this in the stories, is that the agents are very much aware of the federal fair housing law. They find ways to use code and ways to steer them. One of the ways is, instead of saying that this is an African American or a mixed neighborhood, they'll say there are bad schools there, and that's
there's
the code.
There's gang activity.
Gang activity, which they didn't tell, they wouldn't tell the minority prospective buyers. So there's a lot to this, a lot more. Governor Cuomo, Attorney General Tish James are investigating. There's probably going to be a lot more around the state and a lot more cracking down. Interestingly, I talked to former Attorney General Robert Abrams, who said he did the same thing and found the same thing 25 years ago.
That's pretty stunning, I have to say. But Long Island has kind of a legacy of not being exactly diverse, right? It was the original suburbs in the 1950s, Robert Moses built all those parkways that had underpasses that were too low for buses to get through. The idea being, if you're poor and you don't have a car, you shouldn't be out here. So it is kind of sad to see that legacy, you know, is still lasting.
And what was fascinating is that the way this has gotten down to almost a science is that the African-American buyers had no idea that they were being treated differently. You had to have the pairing of the whites and the blacks,
yeah.
And that's where it was. Because, you know, it's all smiles and handshakes and this is all the stuff, but if you see them next to each other, they're treated differently.
Well, people can see it because Newsday, much to its credit, has dropped its paywall, so people everywhere can take a look at this story. It comes with a very good documentary that includes a lot of that hidden camera footage that we were talking about.
And hopefully it will inspire them to subscribe.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes.
For good journalism.
We want to move on from the southernmost stretch of New York mm-hmm. to the northernmost, specifically Representative Elise Stefanik's district, where in the wake of her very high-profile role, she is on the Intel Committee mm-hmm. in Congress, in the impeachment inquiry, she has gained a lot of attention, praise from the president, praise from the president's supporters, but also brickbats from the president's critics and a money bomb for her likely 2018 opponent, Tedra Cobb.
Well, she certainly raised her profile nationally. And it's interesting because she was never all that big of a Trump supporter, but she's decided to make her name in these impeachment hearings. She's the only Republican woman on that committee. When they have the press conferences afterwards, she's always standing right next to Jim Jordan, the ranking member, and you know, she always has something to say about it. They've decided that they are definitely gonna spotlight her for both good and bad. But it is a strongly Republican district in the North Country, so I guess she figures that standing with Trump now is going to help her in her reelection next year.
Tedra Cobb has received $1 million over the course of last weekend in donations. And she has been now billed by Stefanik's campaign as, I believe it's Tinseltown Tedra?
Or something, or Taxing Tedra, or
taxing
whatever.
Tedra's
they like alliteration, yeah. I guess. But yeah, saying that, oh, Hollywood people want to influence you, people in the North Country, and you don't want, you know, Hollywood telling you what to do. So, but I think it's going to be a much more hot race now after Elise Stefanik has certainly raised her profile on this. So it's interesting to watch and see what happens next. Did she make the right gamble?
Right. We spoke last week at the roundtable a lot about the Jacob leak investigation. Mm-hmm. The IG's office looked at this for 9 months. There were new revelations in my paper, The Times Union, this week that it was, in fact, an assembly aide named Howard Vargas who reached out to Julie Garcia, a Jacob commissioner, and let her know that the governor was upset with the way she voted on a matter behind closed doors in Jacob. Of course, a leak from Jacob is illegal. We also found out that the state inspector general, which, as I said, spent 9 months looking at this matter, never saw the need to interview either Carl Hastie or Andrew Cuomo, who apparently had this conversation about the leaked material.
And as you mentioned, the assembly aide, not just an aide, he's one of the top counsels to Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie. But I thought it was interesting in the article you guys asked Hastie's spokesman, you know, why did this counsel reach out to her? And they said, oh, well, he just did that on his own. We didn't tell him to do that. He just decided one day he would call her.
This adds to the narrative of Jacob, of being an organization that was created by Governor Cuomo. It was, the structure is set up so that former Governor Cuomo appointees are heads of staff and keys on the board. The legislature signed on to this 10 years ago because they have, in effect, veto power. So what you have is a very ineffective board, potentially powerful, that covers ethics and lobbying, but is missed the biggest ethics and lobbying investigations in the state history in the last 10 years. It was all done by feds. It's like Jacob is like, there's no one too small for Jacob to go after.
Unless you're a big name, right? They don't see it.
Just to follow up on the point you made, Karen, about the assembly saying that, geez, we don't know why Howard mm-hmm. Vargas reached out. When we asked the assembly, when we asked Carl Hastie's office, if they ever asked Vargas for his reasoning, they said, no comment, which is both hilarious and kind of sad. But moving on, we want to talk about a story that Mike broke this week, which he reported that Governor Andrew Cuomo has still not given up on the idea of a potential presidential run next year.
He's still talking about it with some of his closest aides, or has been talking about it with some of his closest aides. Back when Joe Biden, his who he supports, was starting to fade or appeared to fade back in the fall. So that's when they were talking about what if, was there a route? That group, you know, maintains that they're still very close to the governor. So the conversation had come up through the fall. Now that Joe Biden is doing better, the talks, as far as I understand it, are not going on. But this was a serious consideration. And the governor had seriously, according to the sources, seriously considered a run. All this time he's been saying, since he was reelected, that he wasn't going to run for president. So this is what's going on inside.
With Bloomberg announcing.
And the governor denies it, by the way.
Yeah. Oh,
with Bloomberg announcing and Deval Patrick announcing, you wonder if he isn't having second thoughts. I mean, it's not too late to get in.
He's got a lot of supporters who see that a way that he could get in there, be a centrist, and make a difference.
He's probably the only one who hasn't gotten in at this point, right, that's been mentioned.
Mike, you're going to love Iowa in January. It's great.
I do love Iowa in January. I've been there.
Very quickly, there's a new Siena poll out that shows that Joe Biden is actually back in favor in New York.
That's right. And Elizabeth Warren second, Bernie Sanders third. But it's still a ways to go.
All right, that's where we're going to have to leave it. Thanks very much to Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio and Mike Gormley of Newsday.
To learn more about what we covered on tonight's show, head over to New York Now's website at nynow.org. Until next week, I'm Ray Suarez. This is New York Now.